In the spring of 1864, Abraham Lincoln made a decision that would alter the course of American history. After 3 years of bloody civil war with minimal progress, he summoned Ulysses S. Grant east to take command of all Union armies. Within a year, the war ended with the Union preserved and slavery abolished. Grant's personal memoirs, completed just days before his death from throat cancer in 1885, provides remarkable insight into this pivotal period and the man who helped save the nation. Born Hiram Ulysses Grant in 1822, he was a study in contrasts. Revered as a military genius, yet controversial for his presidency scandals. A West Point graduate who achieved stunning battlefield success, yet struggled with alcoholism and failed business ventures. Physically unimposing, yet possessing a quiet determination that earned Lincoln's trust as the only real general. Though contemporaries like William Sherman and Mark Twain recognized his brilliance, Grant's reputation declined after his generation passed, only to be rehabilitated by scholars in recent decades. His memoirs, which earned his widow the equivalent of $8 million in today's money, are now considered a masterpiece of American literature for their clarity, directness, and intelligence, qualities that define both his writing and his generalship. Grant's military education began formally at West Point, an institution he entered reluctantly in 1839. "I had always a great aversion to guns," he wrote candidly, never having planned a military career. His father's insistence, rather than personal ambition, led him to the academy. At West Point, he excelled in mathematics and horsemanship, ranking among the top riders in his class. His equestrian skills would later prove invaluable during his military campaigns. Though academically middle-ranked, he displayed a remarkable memory for detail and literature, often entertaining fellow cadets with lengthy recitations from novels. His name itself underwent a significant transformation when the congressman who appointed him mistakenly registered him as Ulysses S. Grant rather than Hiram Ulysses Grant. Rather than correct the error, Grant adopted the new name, which followed him throughout his career, with many later speculating that the S stood for Simpson, his mother's maiden name. The Mexican War, 1846 to 1848, provided Grant's true military education, though he considered it one of the most unjust ever waged by a stronger against a weaker nation. Despite his moral objections, Grant distinguished himself in combat, participating in every major battle under General Zachary Taylor and later General Winfield Scott. At Monterey, he volunteered for a dangerous mission to secure ammunition, riding through enemy-controlled streets while under heavy fire. His actions earned him a brevet promotion and recognition from his superiors. During Scott's march to Mexico City, Grant demonstrated tactical creativity by having men haul a howitzer into a church belfry, firing down on enemy positions to devastating effect. This innovative thinking foreshadowed his later reputation for unconventional military solutions. This conflict provided Grant with invaluable experience and relationships that would later prove crucial during the Civil War. Nearly all the officers who would lead both Union and Confederate armies served together in Mexico, including Robert E. Lee, George Meade, and James Longstreet. Grant observed firsthand the contrasting leadership styles of generals like Taylor, who dressed casually and gave simple, direct orders, and Scott, who was formal and meticulous in planning. "I felt like a perfectly raw recruit beside them," Grant admitted, yet he absorbed crucial lessons about logistics, tactics, and leadership. He particularly noted how Taylor's straightforward approach to command and ability to adapt to circumstances influenced his own later leadership style. After the war, Grant married Julia Dent in 1848, daughter of a Missouri slave owner, beginning a devoted partnership that would sustain him through future hardships. He was stationed at various frontier posts, including Fort Vancouver in the Oregon Territory and Fort Humboldt in California. The isolation and boredom of these assignments, combined with separation from his growing family, contributed to his drinking problems. In 1854, facing an ultimatum from his commander, Colonel Robert Buchanan, about his alcohol use, Grant resigned his commission. This was the severest struggle of my life, he confessed, beginning a difficult civilian period marked by failed farming and business ventures in St. Louis and Galena, Illinois. These setbacks, however, would ultimately prepare him for his triumphant return to military service during the Civil War. When the Civil War erupted in 1861, Grant was working as a clerk in his father's leather goods store in Galena, Illinois, a humble position that belied his military education and experience. Initially helping to drill local volunteers, his West Point background in Mexican War service quickly distinguished him from other civilian recruiters. Within weeks, he received a colonel's commission to command the 21st Illinois Infantry Regiment, where he rapidly established a reputation for discipline and organization. His rise thereafter was meteoric, demonstrating an unusual combination of tactical skill and strategic vision that set him apart from his peers. After capturing Fort Donelson in February 1862, where his famous demand for unconditional surrender earned him the nickname Unconditional Surrender Grant, and captured over 14,000 Confederate troops, he was promoted to Major General. This victory represented the Union's first major success of the war and established Grant as a commander who could deliver results. The fort's capture secured a crucial position on the Cumberland River and opened Tennessee to Union advances. Grant's command philosophy differed fundamentally from most Union generals of the era. While others, like George McClellan, focused on capturing territory or the Confederate capital of Richmond, Grant understood that destroying Confederate armies was the key to victory. "The art of war is simple enough," he explained. "Find out where your enemy is, get at him as soon as you can, strike him as hard as you can and as often as you can, and keep moving on." This aggressive doctrine stood in stark contrast to the cautious, defensive mindset that had previously characterized Union strategy. This aggressive approach nearly ended his career at Shiloh in April 1862, when Confederate forces under Albert Sidney Johnson surprised his army at Pittsburgh Landing. The battle's first day was disastrous, with Union troops driven back to the Tennessee River and thousands of casualties. Critics in Washington and the press called for Grant's removal, but he demonstrated remarkable composure under pressure. He reorganized his forces overnight, incorporated reinforcements under Don Carlos Buell, and launched a decisive counterattack the next morning, turning apparent defeat into a significant victory. "I never despaired of ultimate success," he wrote. The battle revealed Grant's remarkable resilience, a quality that would define his generalship throughout the war. The Vicksburg Campaign of 1862-63 demonstrated Grant's strategic genius and operational flexibility. After several failed conventional approaches, including attempts to dig canals and navigate bayous, he made a bold decision to march his army down the west bank of the Mississippi, cross below Vicksburg, and attack from the east, cutting loose from his supply lines to live off the country. "I determined to move independently of roads and supply trains," he explained. This unconventional approach succeeded brilliantly. Grant's army conducted a lightning campaign through Mississippi, defeating Confederate forces under John C. Pemberton in five separate battles at Port Gibson, Raymond, Jackson, Champion Hill, and Big Black River Bridge. He then besieged Vicksburg for 6 weeks before forcing its surrender on July 4, 1863. This victory gave the Union control of the Mississippi River, split the Confederacy in two, and demonstrated Grant's ability to conceive and execute complex large-scale operations. When Lincoln appointed Grant General-in-Chief in March 1864, the war entered its decisive phase. Grant's elevation marked a crucial shift in Union strategy as he brought both his Western successes and a clear strategic vision to the role. He immediately developed a comprehensive strategy of coordinated attacks across all theaters to prevent Confederate forces from reinforcing each other, a fundamental weakness in previous Union campaigns. Grant would personally accompany Meade's Army of the Potomac against Lee in Virginia, while Sherman moved against Johnston in Georgia, and smaller Union forces would advance in the Shenandoah Valley and toward Mobile, Alabama. The resulting Overland Campaign was the war's bloodiest and most sustained offensive. Beginning with the Battle of the Wilderness in May 1864, Grant pushed relentlessly southward despite horrific casualties that would have caused his predecessors to retreat. The Wilderness itself was a confused and brutal battle fought in dense woodland that negated Union advantages in artillery and nullified traditional tactics. Unlike previous Union commanders who retreated after such setbacks, Grant kept pressing forward. After the Wilderness battle, he famously turned south instead of north, causing his troops to cheer when they realized they wouldn't retreat. "Whatever happens, there will be no turning back," he told his staff, demonstrating the determination that would characterize the entire campaign. The campaign continued through a series of increasingly costly engagements. At Spotsylvania Courthouse, Union forces launched repeated attacks against Confederate entrenchments in the Bloody Angle, fighting hand-to-hand for nearly 24 hours in the rain. The Battle of North Anna River showcased Lee's tactical brilliance, but also revealed his army's diminishing offensive capability. The campaign reached a bloody climax at Cold Harbor, where Grant ordered a massive frontal assault against well-prepared Confederate positions on June 3. The attack resulted in approximately 7,000 Union casualties in less than an hour, leading to one of Grant's few public admissions of error. "I have always regretted that the last assault at Cold Harbor was ever made," he wrote in his memoirs. Yet Grant's resolution remained unshaken. He continued maneuvering, executing a brilliant movement across the James River that caught Lee by surprise and brought Union forces to the doorstep of Petersburg, Richmond's crucial supply hub. Though the resulting 9-month siege of Petersburg lasted longer than Grant had hoped, his strategy of continuous pressure was working. Lee's army was gradually worn down while Sherman captured Atlanta and marched through Georgia, and Sheridan cleared the Shenandoah Valley. Grant's ability to coordinate these far-flung operations demonstrated his strategic vision and organizational skills. "The armies were now working together like a machine," he wrote with satisfaction, as the noose slowly tightened around the Confederacy. By April 1865, Lee's position had become militarily untenable. The Confederate supply lines were severed, his troops were surviving on minimal rations, and desertion rates had skyrocketed. When Petersburg and Richmond fell in quick succession, Lee attempted a desperate maneuver to escape southwest to join Johnston's army in North Carolina, hoping to consolidate what remained of Confederate forces. Grant, however, pursued relentlessly, with Sheridan's cavalry executing a brilliant flanking movement that cut off Lee's retreat near the Appomattox River. On April 9, 1865, surrounded and with his men exhausted and starving, Lee requested a meeting at Appomattox Courthouse to discuss surrender terms. Grant's treatment of Lee and the defeated Confederates revealed his extraordinary character and strategic wisdom. Despite his earlier reputation for demanding unconditional surrender at Fort Donelson and Vicksburg, he offered surprisingly generous terms. Confederate officers could keep their sidearms, pistols, and personal horses, and all soldiers could return home without fear of prosecution if they pledged not to take up arms against the Union again. The meeting itself was remarkably civil, with Grant dressed in a mud-splattered uniform while Lee appeared in an immaculate dress uniform with ceremonial sword. When Grant learned that many Confederate cavalrymen owned their horses, he added a crucial provision allowing them to keep these animals for spring planting, demonstrating remarkable foresight about post-war reconstruction. "I took it that most of the men in the ranks were small farmers," he explained, "and the animals would be needed for the cultivation of their farms and the support of their families." When some jubilant Union officers began firing victory salutes to celebrate the surrender, Grant immediately ordered them to stop. "The war is over," he told them firmly. "The rebels are our countrymen again." This magnanimity closely aligned with Lincoln's expressed desire to bind up the nation's wounds and reflected Grant's own deep understanding that reconciliation, not retribution, was essential for rebuilding the nation. He even ordered Union soldiers to share their rations with the surrendering Confederates, many of whom hadn't eaten in days. The terms at Appomattox became a model for subsequent Confederate surrenders across the South. Grant's generous approach helped ease the transition from war to peace and set an important precedent for national reconciliation. His actions demonstrated that military victory alone was insufficient. The greater challenge lay in winning the peace and reuniting the country. This wisdom would prove invaluable in the difficult years of Reconstruction that followed. Grant's personal memoirs, written as he was dying of throat cancer in 1885, represent one of the most remarkable literary achievements by an American public figure. Facing financial ruin after being swindled in a business venture by Ferdinand Ward, who had operated a Ponzi scheme that devastated Grant's savings, he signed with Mark Twain's publishing company to provide for his family after his death. Despite excruciating pain that required regular doses of cocaine-laced water to numb his throat, he worked methodically for hours each day, often writing up to 50 pages in a sitting, and completed the manuscript just days before he died. The memoirs are distinguished by their clear, direct prose and honest self-assessment. Unlike many 19th-century autobiographies, which often indulged in Victorian verbosity and self-aggrandizement, Grant's writing avoids flowery language and self-justification. He candidly discusses his failures and mistakes, from his resignation from the army in 1854 due to drinking problems, to tactical errors during battles like Cold Harbor. This honesty extends to his assessment of other generals, both Union and Confederate, whom he evaluates with remarkable fairness. His portrayal of Robert E. Lee, for instance, is notably respectful while still acknowledging his opponent's military shortcomings. Grant's literary style mirrors his military approach, straightforward, purposeful, and effective. He focuses on what matters, avoiding unnecessary digressions or embellishments that characterized many Civil War memoirs of the era. His descriptions of battles provide enough detail to understand the strategic situation without becoming bogged down in minutiae. For example, his account of the Vicksburg campaign clearly explains the complex series of movements and failed attempts that preceded the final successful siege while maintaining narrative momentum. The result is a narrative that remains engaging and accessible even to readers without military background. The memoirs also offer invaluable insights into the nature of leadership and decision-making under pressure. Grant's descriptions of key moments, such as his decision to continue advancing after the Battle of the Wilderness rather than retreating like his predecessors, reveal his strategic thinking process. His account of the surrender at Appomattox Courthouse is particularly moving, combining military precision with human empathy. The work's enduring success, it earned his family nearly $450,000, equivalent to multiple millions today, testament to both its literary quality and historical significance. Modern historians and military leaders continue to study the memoirs for their lessons in leadership, strategy, and perseverance. Beyond military matters, Grant's memoirs reveal a man of surprising complexity and depth that challenges many historical stereotypes. Despite his reputation as a butcher who won through superior numbers rather than skill, Grant repeatedly demonstrated tactical creativity and strategic vision that revolutionized warfare. He pioneered modern warfare concepts like coordinated theater-wide operations, utilizing railroads and telegraph networks in unprecedented ways. His understanding of logistics transformed military planning. He was among the first commanders to fully grasp how steam power and industrial capacity could determine battlefield outcomes. His innovative use of cavalry and combined arms operations presaged 20th century warfare. Grant's moral compass remained remarkably steady throughout his life and military career. He opposed the Mexican War on principle, viewing it as an unjust expansion of slavery, yet served honorably because he believed in duty to country. This complex balance between personal conviction and professional obligation would characterize his entire career. He treated conquered Southerners with unprecedented respect and magnanimity at Appomattox, while maintaining an unwavering commitment to emancipation and civil rights for freed slaves. During Reconstruction, he actively supported policies protecting Black Americans' rights, deployed federal troops to suppress the Ku Klux Klan, and championed the 15th Amendment guaranteeing voting rights. Perhaps most striking is Grant's profound humanity and awareness of war's terrible cost. Despite commanding hundreds of thousands of men in bloody campaigns, he never became desensitized to the human suffering. He described walking across fields at Shiloh, where one could have walked across the clearing in any direction, stepping on dead bodies without a foot touching the ground, a haunting image that stayed with him for life. After witnessing the carnage at Cold Harbor, where thousands died in futile charges, he never again ordered frontal assaults against entrenched positions. His letters to Julia reveal how deeply he felt each casualty, often spending sleepless nights thinking of the men lost under his command. Grant's memoirs conclude with an eloquent plea for national reconciliation and hope for the future. "I feel we are on the eve of a new era when there is to be great harmony between the federal and Confederate. I cannot stay to be a living witness to the correctness of this prophecy, but I feel it within me that it is to be so." This vision of reconciliation was remarkable coming from a man who had seen the worst of the conflict. Though the full realization of this hope would take more than a century, Grant's generous terms at Appomattox and his consistent support for both reconciliation and civil rights laid its foundation. His personal evolution from a failed businessman to the nation's most successful general, and finally to an advocate for peace and racial justice, embodies the transformation he hoped to see in the nation itself. The Civil War transformed Ulysses S. Grant from a failed businessman into America's most celebrated general. His unique combination of strategic vision, tactical flexibility, moral courage, and sheer determination made him the perfect counterpart to Abraham Lincoln in preserving the Union and ending slavery. Where other generals saw obstacles, Grant saw opportunities. Where others sought to avoid battle, Grant sought to engage the enemy. Where others became paralyzed by setbacks, Grant adapted and pressed forward. This was particularly evident in his Vicksburg campaign, where he abandoned conventional military wisdom by separating from his supply lines and maneuvering his army with unprecedented mobility. Grant's greatness lay not in brilliance or charisma, but in his fundamental understanding of what the war required and his unwavering commitment to seeing it through. Unlike his predecessors, who often became entangled in political considerations or personal glory, Grant maintained an unwavering focus on strategic objectives. His campaigns in Tennessee, particularly at Shiloh and Chattanooga, demonstrated his ability to learn from setbacks and adapt his tactics while maintaining strategic momentum. As Lincoln said, "Grant is the first general I've had. He doesn't ask me to do the impossible." In a war where many generals were paralyzed by caution or ambition, Grant focused single-mindedly on victory, understanding that the Union's superior resources could only be decisive if aggressively employed. His command style was marked by clarity and directness. Unlike many of his contemporaries who wrote lengthy, elaborate battle orders, Grant's instructions were remarkably concise and clear. During the Overland Campaign of 1864, he demonstrated his resolve by continuing to engage Lee's army despite heavy casualties, famously declaring, "I propose to fight it out on this line if it takes all summer." This persistence, though costly, ultimately proved decisive in wearing down the Confederacy's ability to resist. His memoirs preserve not just the story of his campaigns, but the essence of his character, the quiet determination, moral clarity, and fundamental decency that made him, in many ways, the quintessential American hero. Rising from humble origins through merit rather than privilege, overcoming personal failures through perseverance, and exercising power with restraint and humanity, Grant embodied the best of American values. His magnanimous treatment of Lee's army at Appomattox set a tone of reconciliation that would prove crucial in the war's aftermath. The final words of his memoirs, written while racing against terminal cancer to provide for his family, reflect both his personal struggle with terminal illness and his hope for the nation he helped preserve. I cannot stay to be a living witness to the correctness of this prophecy, but I feel it within me that it is to be so. In this, as in so much else, Grant's judgment proved sound. The nation he fought to preserve would indeed become stronger and more united, though the road would be longer and harder than he might have hoped. His legacy extends beyond his military achievements to his presidency, where he worked to protect the rights of freed slaves and restore national unity, though these efforts would be partially undone in the decades following his death.